and decisions about dying tonight. I'm Mary Carlson, just for review. This is Dan Spencer. I don't know that we'll say anything more by way of introduction, but we appreciate everybody being here this evening with us. Dan's going to start us out, I think, with a little review brief from yesterday.
Just want to do a very brief recap of what we did yesterday before we go turn to the topic for tonight and introduce the case study. So we mentioned yesterday we're going to follow a case study approach to dealing with questions of ethics this week. Yesterday we walked through very briefly at the end one case study, and today you're all going to be on your own in small groups discussing a case that we have gathered. But wanted to just briefly review what all these newsprint sheets are up here, and then you can forget them if you'd like. But what we tried to do yesterday was to begin to work at having both a common vocabulary to be able to talk to each other about matters of ethics, and also to introduce some basic ethical principles that guide our decision-making about ethics. Many of these are intuitive principles that we already have a gut feeling for. We were just trying to name them, again, to give us a working vocabulary. And then at the end, we introduced a model for ethical decision-making. So up here, the second piece of news sheet here are some of the common terms that are commonly employed in ethics with very brief definitions next to them. If they're helpful for you to make reference to them in your discussions, fine. If they get in the way, don't worry about them. But they're one way when we talk about them in the large group, we may come back and point out when we're using some of these different terms. Similarly, we introduce a series of basic ethical principles. And one of the things we're going to ask you to do in the case study tonight is to think about what are some of the principles you think are involved in making this ethical dilemma. Again, an ethical dilemma is when there are ethical values or principles that are in conflict in a given situation, and you have to make a choice about which ones to respect. So these, you can use this as a list of reference of some of the principles. You may have others that you want to introduce into the conversation. And then we spent the second half of yesterday's session introducing one model for ethical decision making. And that's what we're going to ask you to work through tonight in the case study. The first three steps of the model having to do with analyzing the situation by gathering the relevant information and coming up with alternatives. And the second half there being the moral assessment of what are the possibilities, thinking about these in light of your values and commitments. One of the things we neglected to do when we introduced the model yesterday was to mention where we had gotten it from. And so Mary is going to give proper credit at this point.
Good academics shouldn't be forgetting this. Dr. Ron Hamill is currently an ethicist with the Park Ridge Center for the Study of Health, Faith, and Ethics, which is affiliated with Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago. Some of you might be familiar with them. Dr. Hamill, prior to that, was a professor of ethics and religion at Hamline University in St. Paul. So I had several opportunities to hear him speak and also work with him on an AIDS and ethics panel, and got this model from him, essentially. He probably would say, again, it's a composite of other models for decision making, but I've found it's a real helpful one to sort of grasp. Also, before I get started, I just want to mention two books in the bookstore that we suggested for this week, primarily a book called Taking Sides, edited by Carol Levine, that has, I believe, 15 different hot ethical issues in medicine right now, and argues both the pro and con, or yes and no sides of those issues. Arguments by leading ethicists and theologians in our country. I really recommend it. It's written well and easily understood for fairly lay audiences, although you'll all be experts after all this. The other is sort of a segue from this week to next week's topics that I'll be doing on AIDS and HIV. It's called The AIDS Reader, Social, Political, and Ethical Issues. The AIDS epidemic is bringing up infinitely more ethical dilemmas for us as a society, not just for the health professionals, so I encourage this one also for your reading. I also have a bibliography on ethics, medical ethics in particular. I only had one copy because it's very long. People are free to peruse it and make notes of resources that might be good for you.
Let me mention one other thing. The last thing that we just introduced yesterday in terms of thinking about ethical approaches was introduced three different ethical approaches, and I'll just very briefly review them here. You can judge for yourself. People tend to lean one way or the other when they think about doing ethics, and it may be helpful for you tonight as we go through the case study to think which of these models seems more appropriate for you. The first one is sometimes called an absolutist model or sometimes called a deontological model. What it means is that it pays attention to the means that are employed in any kind of ethical decision. The emphasis in this approach is on ethical obligations and rules and duties that all of us need to follow. We gave the example yesterday of such things as stealing is always wrong, telling the truth is always correct. Those kinds of ethical obligations and rules that are the means in any situation, and those are what are binding. One of the assumptions of this is that human beings are always to be treated as ends, not as means themselves in a decision. And in the deontological method pays primary emphasis on the individual. It says basically that individual rights can never be abridged for the common good. So if you hold absolutely fundamental individual rights, chances are you're working out of this kind of framework. The second one is what we call consequentialist or ends-oriented ways of doing ethics. And that is looking at the probable outcome of different scenarios and evaluating those in terms of what's the most ethical. So consequentialists tend to try and maximize the good and minimize bad consequences by anticipating what consequences are. An easy way to remember this is one of the principles is the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Therefore, consequentialists tend to emphasize the common order, and they will put emphasis on community and maximizing human welfare as where the priority lies in ethical decision making. Then the third one that we just talked about didn't do too much more with, but recognition that many of us work out of what we would call a mixed or a contextual approach, which means we may be guided by principles, obligations, and duties, as is the first approach, the absolutist. But we also consider it important to consider consequences, and so we may weigh these two in order to try and resolve our dilemma. I just introduced these so that you be aware in your conversations. You may find out that if you have a disagreement in your small group, that some of you are operating out of one of these models, some of you are operating the other, and that may be the source of it in terms of where greater priority or weight lies for you. And we'll have a chance then when we debrief this all to talk about how these influence each of these. Just the last thing I want to mention in that is that in the basic ethical principles that we outline, the first seven here, which I put a red bracket around, are what we would call the deontological principles. That is, they are the principles that are considered always to be operative without regard to consequences. Basic respect for persons, confidentiality, honesty, and so forth. While the latter three, 8 through 10, are what we would consider to be consequentialist principles because they are made on the basis of probable outcome, that it's important to promote the whole well-being of people for that outcome. Utility, we already talked about the greatest good for good and the greatest number. Weighing burden versus benefit means you have to take into consideration consequences. And so these are, which of these may you give priority to in a conflict between them may tell you which of these approaches you're more apt to be following.
Just going to help clear this a little bit.
Yes.
Red
is deontological and green is consequential.
Okay, for tonight.
If you're red, green, colorblind, I can't even tell between these two right here. But
some people are. We very consciously chose the topic or the title for tonight to be decisions about dying, not decisions about death. Because much of what we're talking about here is the process prior to dying for tonight's, prior to the moment of death for tonight's case example. So we were very careful about it. One way I want to bring this into sort of an introductory comment is to say the American Medical Association of our country has predicted that between 80 and 90% of us will die what's called a managed death. What do you suppose that means?
Somebody else inside.
Somebody else inside. Like who? Yeah. Hospital?
Yeah.
Family, children. Nursing homes? Hospices? Home care agencies? Sort of anybody but me. 80 to 90% of us. So that's a slight difference from 50 years ago, would you say? Or 100 years ago. So I don't think what we're talking about tonight is academic. We're out sort of in the future. I think most of us have had some experience with that. It means that we're probably not going to die immediately of a heart attack, all of us, or immediately in a car accident. That's essentially the two ways I think of dying fast without any sort of management. I don't like the notion of manage death, as Dan points out. So it's kind of clinical, kind of antiseptic, but that's what the AMA came out with. So I want us to think about that a little bit in terms of introduction. And as we start, I wonder if there are folks in the audience, maybe three or four of you, who would be willing to talk briefly with us about an experience you are personally aware of or familiar with of a managed death. Your family, friends, anybody willing to just sort of briefly talk about that and maybe tell us what some of the dilemmas were or what the dilemma was? Just to get our juices flowing a little, yeah.
My brother had to make a decision several years ago whether to have a heart transplant. And it was the first at one of the major metropolitan hospitals to be performed. And whether or not, would his insurance cover it, he could not live outside of the hospital without a heart transplant.
Okay. Sounds like a couple of dilemmas, perhaps. One being that this would be the first one performed. So at that hospital, he might be a little nervous about what that was going to be. Was he going to die without it fairly quickly? I mean, weeks, months, days?
I was pretty certain that that would happen very soon.
Pretty quickly,
yeah.
Okay. So the risk of getting a transplanted organ, whatever risk that might involve, versus the wish to stay alive. And maybe some questions about quality, looking at what life chances people with heart transplants may have.
Okay. And then do we call it suicide when you don't do it?
Oh, good. If he says no, does the family say he's trying to kill himself and will he listen to us? And was there some family disagreement about it at all? Somebody should, anybody shouldn't?
I think my mother was not so sure about this, you know. He didn't believe it.
Okay.
I think we all had to do a lot of talking about how we felt about it.
Sure,
you know.
Sure. Good example. Okay, thank you. Others?
I'm sorry, you said you did go through with it.
Yes.
With the transplant.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. With what? Which option?
Yes.
Okay, good. Another hand. Yeah.
Well, one is probably common nowadays. My mother-in-law, when she was in her last days, slipped into unconsciousness and the decision was made with our consent that she should go to the hospital, and she was treated with blood transfusions and came back to where she was coherent again and didn't remember a whole lot about that night. But then she was not eating well. It was toward her last days. And it happened again. And the question is, do you go through that again and for what purpose? And we had talked some about it, but not very specifically, but we decided that no, that to give blood transfusions and pump her up just to go through that whole episode again is not the decision we're going to do. But mm-hmm. Again, it's a question of how do you spend your last days.
Yeah, quality of life at the end. Also, it sounds like she wasn't able to make the decision herself.
No, she was
okay.
Not able to communicate.
So it's an autonomy question with substituted judgment, substituted decision makers for her. Was there a probability of how frequently this would happen?
Yeah.
Hard to say. Could be every week, could be every year.
And she could have, for all we know, she could have revived again without it too. You just don't know.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of uncertainty about the future of her medical situation. Okay, good example. You over here?
Maybe one more.
One more? Yeah.
Well, I don't remember exactly all the details because I was younger, but my grandfather had always been a real strong man, very independent. He had an aneurysm, and he was deteriorating for two years. And I remember being at the house and him crying, saying how he wanted to die. He didn't want to be, you know, dependent on other people. He didn't want to die in the hospital. He always wanted to die at home. But my grandmother had arthritis. Both the kids, my mom and my uncle, lived too far away to really need her to help. And he finally died after 2 years. His mind was there, but his body wasn't.
So his aneurysm was where?
It's in his brain.
In his brain, okay.
And he finally died after 2 years in the hospital, which, you know, was the one thing he didn't want to do.
Yeah.
You know, for me, being a kid, always seeing him strong, seeing him tear like that, seeing him cry was really hard, you know, for me. I didn't, you know, understand everything that the hospital did, but there was a lot of times that they called my mom and she had to fly down because they thought he was going to die, and then the hospital did something he didn't. And
a lot of stress for him.
Hanging on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it sounds like one question being the rights of your grandfather versus the rights of your grandmother, if she didn't feel she could necessarily care for him at home, and maybe if at the end he couldn't really tell where he was, maybe then it was okay to have him be in the hospital, even though we knew we really didn't want to do that. That's a difficulty. And what is the duty or obligation of a spouse to care for somebody at home till the end?
They had some hospice care, but I don't know. I guess it wasn't enough to keep him at home because it was so involved.
Okay. So he did die in the hospital, mm-hmm. which is what he said he wanted to do. The issue of autonomy there?
He didn't want to.
Didn't want to do. Yeah. Okay. That gets us thinking along some certainly difficult lines, clear lines, things that relate real well, I think, to the case we're going to talk about tonight. Dan's going to introduce the case and talk a little about how to do it, how we're going to do it in a small group, and then we'll spend a little time in those groups.
As Mary mentioned, and this is going to be the emphasis throughout the week, we really want people to bring their own experiences, their own life experiences, their own faith values, their own questions, and principles into these small group discussions. And if these are helpful as ways to guide that, great, but we really want to trust your experience as the primary resource. What we're going to ask folks to do now is to break up into groups of 5 or 6 folks and ask that you do so with people that, make sure your small group has at least a couple people that you don't know, so that we're mixing up a little bit here. We want to have a chance to learn from each other in these things. Once we get into those small groups, I'm going to distribute the case studies, we'll read them over together, and then we're going to go through this model. We'll start by going through step one of gathering the relevant facts and information as a large group, so that we make sure we're all starting with the same information, and then turn you loose on the rest of it here. But let's take a minute to reshuffle the room a little bit and see if you can gather in groups of 5 or 6. And we'll probably end up with about one copy of the case, one written copy per small group. Tape Ministry, keep us on for just a minute. We're going to do a few more things to read the case, and then we'll have you pause the tape. Yeah. Should give me some of these. It should be. You got 5 out there. 5. We're going to read it out loud, so I'll have you read along with us.
Everybody want to listen up, you can also hear it when Dan reads it.
Let me just mention, though, what we'd like to do is have each group designate one person as a recorder, just to jot down a few notes that your group is talking about as you go through. We have a few sheets of scratch paper here, not much. You can also write in the back of those case studies. And then we'll come back later. We're going to take about 25 or 30 minutes, so roughly until around 7:30 or so in the small groups. Let me read the case, and you, those of you who can read along, fine. This case study is called God and My Children Will Know What's Best. Anna is a 61-year-old white woman who is widowed. She is in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's disease, to the point where she no longer speaks, walks, feeds herself, or recognizes family. She has lived in a nursing home for 4.5 years. She has a history of a repaired hip fracture and some bleeding, which the physician thinks is an indication of cancer. She is currently diagnosed with pneumonia, which, if not treated through intravenous antibiotics, will result in her death. She has no living will, and when pressed earlier by her 5 children about what her wishes would be for treatment at the terminal stages of life, responded, "God and my children will know what's best for me." She is a Lutheran pastor's wife and is a woman of deep faith. The children are given the choice of whether to hospitalize Anna for the IV antibiotics or not. If treated, the pneumonia would probably clear up, though the doctor has stated it is likely to recur again and again, probably ending her life within a matter of months. If untreated, Anna would likely die within a week. One of Anna's children is your best friend and asks your advice. The question we'd like you to consider is, what do you say to your friend to help this family make this decision? And what the way we'd like you to do it is to have you work through the steps of the model that we introduced before as a means of coming up with the things that then you will tell the friend at the end of your small group time together. Now, just again briefly reviewing this, we're going to do step number one together, gathering relevant facts and information. If you're not clear about things, need something clarified, we have a little bit more information we want to give you. But then after that, we'd like you to spend a little time together to see what you think are the ethical issues or dilemma involved in this case study. There may be one, there may be several, but you identify those and then move from that into generating some different alternatives that are possible, that you could talk through as a friend. Also considering the consequences of each of those. What are the good and bad consequences of them? What are the short-term and long-term consequences? We'd like you then to move into this section of moral assessment. The first step forward there being to assess these alternatives and consequences in light of the relevant values and principles that you've identified. How is each one of these affected by the principles of, say, autonomy or of justice or of burden benefit, those kinds of things. To then, when you've done that, to assess what the underlying motives might be in these alternatives. Are your motives ethical here? And finally, to choose one of the alternatives and understand how you would justify that choice. Now, let me just mention one thing here. We've set up a model that can be used in any basic ethical decision making. We'd encourage people, since this is by and large a community of faith, in steps 4 through 6, when you're doing moral assessment, to consider how your own faith view or worldview influences the kinds of moral assessments you make as you go through. That may be one way of flushing out similarities and differences in your group.
Okay, we're going to start with step one here as a large group. Let me add a couple additional pieces of information and then open it up to questions any of you might want to ask about this case study. First, may or may not make a difference, Anna is in a Lutheran nursing home in Minnesota. Okay. Secondly, in Minnesota, the law is, and I suspect it's similar in most states, Anna, as a widow, has as legal next of kin her 5 adult children equally. Because Anna did not specify that any of them would be a primary decision maker for her. So her 5 adult children are equal decision makers. Thirdly, we said Anna did not have a living will. It's sort of a layperson's term. The official term is an advance directive to physicians or some similar term. That meant she wrote nowhere that what she would want to have done in this particular situation. So there's nothing listed in writing. Even though in Minnesota, as in about 41 states, I think as of this year, such an advance directive in writing is legal and recognized by the medical community. I'll just add those 3 things. What else do you want to know about this case? And I'll decide whether I tell you or not. Yeah.
When was Anna asked how you was to make the decision? Was she in a coherent state, or
no.
Was she into the advanced stages of
development? Very advanced. When was she asked about? Early. One of her children was real aware of what happens in Alzheimer's and said, "Mom, we need to talk about this." And Anna said, "You'll know what's best, and God will know what's best." Mm-hmm. Good question. Like 6 years, 7 years before.
I heard something about that the doctor said that even if she had was cured of this pneumonia, that it was likely to happen again and again. Mm-hmm. Is that really true?
Very likely. She's in a nursing home. Pneumonia is very common. Pneumonia is the primary killer of people with Alzheimer's disease. That's what they most often die of, primarily because they're so immobile that it's real easy to catch the bug and the lungs fill up with pneumonia. Very likely it happens over and over.
Can you tell anything? I'm sorry, if someone else.
No, okay.
Do we know, even though that was your direct statement, do we know from other more informal conversations your children had with her what her views were toward this kind of thing in general? In other words, did she ever have to face this situation with her husband or a friend? And if so...
Do you know this person? That's a good question.
What did you...
In general, Anna never talked about this. However, her husband died 12 years before this of a heart attack. He'd had one a month earlier. He was in a hospital. He had another attack. They did CPR, brought him back. They did CPR again, brought him back. Finally, the doctor pulled Anna aside and said, you know, I'm not sure it's going to work if we have to do it again, and it's really tough on your husband. And she said, leave it. Let him go next time. So that was one situation with her husband.
I have a real critical question. If we're trying to deal with ethically with our friend, what is the relationship of the other four siblings? Do we know anything about them?
To your friend?
Yeah.
What would you like to know about them? What's important to know, do you think?
Well, is what my friend going to decide going to be in conflict with how many of the other siblings? Having gone through this, I have three other siblings. There were four of us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was definitely some lines that were drawn very early.
Can I leave that open right now and say there are five children who are equal decision makers, and in your group, you talk about what might come up with that? I think if I told you, it would take away a lot of your process. Is that a fair response to that? Because you point out
it answers
a chunk of the
process. One or two more.
Yeah.
Legally, do all five have to agree?
Legally, all five have to agree to not do something. Otherwise, it's done. If one person says, she goes to the hospital, gets IVs, she goes to the hospital and gets IVs in Minnesota.
Is she in pain?
Yes.
Who knows? The doctor says she's in a light coma, doesn't really believe she's in much pain. However, at the time the decision needs to be made, she has terrible difficulty breathing. And pain medication hasn't been started at this point. So she is in some visible struggle with breathing. Yeah. One more?
Is the potential cancer speculative on the doctor's part?
It is speculative. It's rectal bleeding. It's happened a couple of times. Speculative, not been worked up. Okay, good questions. I think we'll stop them there. Dan and I are going to wander around a little bit and listen to you. We're giving you what?
About 25 minutes.
20, 25 minutes. Go to it, starting with one. If you have more you think you need in your small grouping chat, but otherwise start with two.
Move quickly through, yeah.
And move quickly, that's right. Tape you can turn off now if you'd like.
Yeah, we'll be on 25 minute break here, so the tape room, we'll let you know when we're going to turn on.
Withhold treatment. Withhold treatment. That answers that. Okay, this group? I'm sorry? Withhold? Okay, everybody agreeing? Okay? To withhold or to send her to the hospital? Okay? Three and three.
No question at all.
No question at all, what?
Whenever.
Withhold, no question, okay?
We're going to withhold.
No question?
No question.
Unanimity there? Okay?
Yeah, do what's necessary to keep her comfortable.
Do what's necessary to keep her comfortable. What's that?
I guess it meant even antibiotics. If her breathing was making her very...
Listen up, please.
If her breathing was making her very uncomfortable, I guess we said we'd...
give her one try.
One more try at that, just to ease her pain or her discomfort.
Okay.
Would you check for cancer?
Would you check for cancer?
If she...
That's another question. Good. Okay. Hang on. Let's finish the groups here. Go ahead.
We decided for the sake of the family that we would try treatment one more time for pneumonia.
If it were necessary for the coincidence of the five.
If they all agreed, then
we'll come back, but don't forget that point. For the sake of the
family. Exactly the same part.
That's the argument over here, too. Okay, good.
Withhold treatment now. All of us.
Unanimous withhold treatment? Were you all together?
No.
Okay.
No.
Withhold treatment up there, too. Okay. And they were split. They were split. Okay. Did you want to make one comment?
Our group decided not to tell our friend what to do. We wanted our friend to review her relationship historically with her mother and make the right decision.
Okay.
And our group decided not to tell our friend what to do. And wanted our friend to review her relationship historically with her mother and make her own decision based on what she thought her mother would want.
Okay. Using perhaps some of these notions? Now, I would say that I heard that in a couple of groups, people saying, I wouldn't give advice. I, as a social worker, applaud you all.
Yeah.
Professionals, you know, are paid, many of them, to give advice. Friends generally are paid
or not, to listen, not pay, to listen, and help clarify. And maybe ahead of time you have a little time to do some of these things. And one would be, what's your, the history of what your mother would have wanted or what she said. Okay, good.
Okay, we want to just unpack that just a little bit. Is there one group that would be willing to just talk a little bit, just very briefly go through the process? If you could do a kind of a one-line thing, what did you see as the ethical issue? What were some of the alternatives you posed? And how did you begin to assess them in order to justify your decision? Any group willing to do that with us?
Over here?
Yes,
she will.
Wasn't that ethical to volunteer?
We went to the end and sort of backed into it.
We listened. We felt our ethical issue was moving from the autonomy of self-determination issue to being able to move that to the family, to taking that away, to moving it to
okay.
the family.
All right,
the courts had done that for us. It was still an ethical issue dilemma.
Okay.
Correct.
And what did it come down to? Did it come down to the duty to preserve life versus quality of life? Did it come down to burden benefit kinds of things?
I think it came down to burden benefit. We were really concerned with the long term outcome of the well being of the family unit.
Okay, so you were looking considering both the family unit as well as Anna, the individual,
yes.
as well there. Okay.
Yes. Feeling that as it was spelled out in this scenario, we were talking about a week versus a month.
Okay. So with the information you had there, short-term, longer-term, medium-term kinds of things, as you thought about it, did you find yourselves emphasizing one or the other of these kinds of approaches? Were you considering consequences primarily in this area? Were you considering the ethical obligations and duties primarily? What, or did they both come in there and inform each other?
Mostly consequences.
Mostly consequences.
We were definitely
So looking in the ends-oriented, sort of seeing what are the likely consequences and having that shape your ethical decision.
And let me ask, I might have missed it, but consequences both for Anna and for her children?
Mainly
for
her children.
Mainly for her children.
But also we talked about that if we want one more of the antibiotics with Anna, it may well be more comfortable for her because they would treat the pneumonia. She would probably be more comfortable. I mean, it would not be... We've talked about it being a non-maleficent sort of approach to her care. It would do no harm.
Okay.
In fact, it may ease her comfort.
All right. And I heard you say a couple things there, both for Anna's situation. Also, one of the implications possibly with the concern about what's going to happen with the family is if you can go one more round that it keeps her comfortable, it also gives some time then for the family maybe to make these considerations so that there's no long-term damage to the family.
Because we assume that one or some of the five probably had day-to-day contact with Anna where others didn't.
Ah, okay.
And that some were probably more ready, maybe because of their age and development, more ready for her death than others. And so to give time for everybody to come up to the same point.
So in that whole area, the relevant facts and information, the family relationship with Anna 5 is part of that relevant information.
Yeah. Because being only 61, one of those five was probably fairly young.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me just make another point there, that there is often discussion in these situations about whether putting in IV antibiotics is a do-no-harm.
Yeah.
Because for somebody in end-stage Alzheimer's, Anna, I forget what she weighed, 95 pounds or something?
Mm-hmm.
IV antibiotics can soon collapse the veins and can be painful to restart. Depending on her level of consciousness, difficult to know that for sure. Some medication can be given to sort of help that. But there may be people who say IV antibiotics and a transfer to a hospital can be harmful or not beneficial for him.
So well, Mary, just for myself, I'm just interested, would you put that under non-maleficence or would you put that under burden-benefit, weighing that as burden versus benefit?
Well, I'm generally a consequentialist, so I'd put it under burden-benefit. I would say, generally, personally, the benefit to her is not outweighed by the burden because I had a lot of experience personally with people with Alzheimer's, and the burden of transferring folks
to another place, just moving them by stretcher via ambulance to another part of the city can be a burden.
And we never considered any of that.
Yeah, and often you don't.
But the, probably the child who has, or children who had spent time with her day in, day out would have known that, you know.
They may well have known that.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And we talked about that being a problem, that that child would know, and the child who just flew in from Florida wouldn't know.
And it could be that the day-to-day child is far advanced mm-hmm. in terms of the recognition readiness. And acceptance and readiness to have mom die at some point.
Well, the other thing too, there's five children, and she made a decision earlier about their father's death.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we don't know whether two or three or five of them disagreed with her terribly about that.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, that could be a good family.
Or whether they were too young to have even been brought into it at that point. 12 years earlier,
12 years earlier.
He was 49, 48, something like that.
Very unhappy.
Yeah.
Is there any other group that had a process that was significantly different than the one we just heard from? That there would have been considering different kinds of issues involved or different kinds of weighing it? Group in the corner here?
Well, we felt we were the friend. We weren't the children. Yeah. So we couldn't make that decision.
Mm-hmm. We didn't go through those processes. We went through the processes of helping the friend. Not making the decision of
mm-hmm. So what kinds of things came up as you tried to consider what you would do in the place of a friend?
Well, we said to try and talk him through the financial sorts of decisions and the guilt decisions and how they felt morally about keeping someone alive and letting them come to the decision, but definitely not leading them one way or the other, but allowing them to.
So it sounds like you were able to use some of these kinds of things as a way of asking questions to help the friend clarify where she or he was at.
Because we felt that if we would say what we felt, and that would alienate that friend from the rest of her family,
okay.
We hadn't done anything.
I'm interested, the group that was split up here, what kinds of, where did you find the points of disagreement and where did you find points of commonality as you went through this? They're no longer
standing there.
Anything different from what's been said? Are any of you married? No.
I think we were similar to the reasoning down here. That's why that the persons who favored treatment, I think I'm stating this fairly, is that they thought, well, let's, very similar to this, let's do this. Let's give this one more time, that this antibiotic is not particularly in and of itself expensive, not particularly invasive, and it seemed like not an exceptional thing to do. One person brought up the point, well, this person doesn't feed themselves. And so somebody somewhere already made a decision to go ahead and feed this person to sustain their life. So where is the crossover if you have made that decision and then make the decision not to do it? So those were kind of the dilemmas.
And we did make the decision to keep the case study simple. And the fact of the matter is his family was also being faced with whether to put a feeding tube in or not, because she wasn't eating. So there was that separate issue. I think we need to move on.
Yeah, we need to close this up here. Should I do the Q&A or do you just want to go over?
Let me just ask, before I tell you what happened with the case, we will do that each time. If you're like me, we don't want to be left hanging. We're going to try not to tell you ahead of time. But let me just ask whether people had any strong feelings about discussing this or things that came up for you personally that you'd be wanting to share or needing to share at all.
Well, the one thing that I brought up earlier was the thing that came up the hardest for me, and it boils down to motives, and that was a good assessment of what the problem was. My sister lived in Iowa. The three of us lived in the same town with my mom, and she came back from Iowa and insisted that everything be done, and it was classic, but what were her motives? And I guess in talking about it, you know, in trying to help, that was a good point to bring out. You know, why is she doing all this? Why is she so this way? And I mean, we had a hard time finding, we got to let her do her thing, because we couldn't fight her all the time and help my mom. And then she cut us off from my mom because she didn't want us in there interfering with her care.
Not an uncommon situation and very difficult. And the ramifications long after mom dies are there. For years after with grown kids or,
I guess my other thought was what Anna told her children was not very helpful, right?
Everybody who has children, remember this. Even if you're a believer and you say God will know best and you believe that, it'd be more helpful.
Yeah, my idea of what the mind of God is a little cloudy at times.
It's probably getting cloudier in the 90s at some point. Okay, anybody else a feeling reaction?
Well, I would just like to say something in regard to what he's saying is that inasmuch as she did infer that God would know that prayer would need to be present somewhere in this meeting with the kids to seek guidance.
Let me just ask, how many folks have found themselves in some situation similar to this scenario, either directly or being asked as a friend to help them hear something through and stuff? Yeah, just a show of hands. You know, this is a not an uncommon situation at all. And I think the questions the group in the corner brought up about how do you be a, how do you best be a friend in it are not easy ones to answer either. We will we'll be doing a bunch of a different scenario each day as we go through these different things during the week. We're trying to take both a different topic and put yourself in a different position each time. But ones that we think that all of us will have a good likelihood of being having at least some of these touch us during our lifetimes here. And one thing that I would ask you, we won't take time tonight to really talk about it, but as you think back about the process went tonight, what would you say would be some of the key learnings that you got out of this, about this kind of process of working with a group and trying to work through a model? What were some of the helpful things? What were some of the constraints? That kind of stuff. We may have a chance to talk more about that later in the week.
Let me tell you what happened. In this particular situation, about 2 months prior to this decision having to be made, the family had a family meeting. With just the five kids, no spouses involved, to talk about eventualities, feeding tube or not, IV antibiotics or not. And essentially, the children decided and agreed that they didn't want to do further invasive anything, and they did see IV antibiotics as invasive because she had to be transferred to a hospital. And decided against a feeding tube, which didn't have to be decided because the pneumonia then came up. In this particular case, one of the sons had lived in Chicago for the previous 10 years, had been involved very little with mom's care at all. Fortunately, in the last year, had been sort of reunited with family, had visited a lot, and he said during this meeting, I was very close to mom when I was a child. It was real important to her that she be with God at some point. And when she made the decision about dad, I struggled with it, but I think she was right, and I think this is what she would want. The group talked about, the kids talked about what mom would want, then they talked about what each of them would want. They prayed, they did a lot of crying together, talked with me about how that went. Anna stayed in the nursing home, was given some antibiotics by injection, because one of the kids said, is there a way to give her a shot in the nursing home? A little bit of doubt there, right? She got a couple shots. The doctor said, that's really all we can try by injection. I think we ought to just let it go. And she died about 5 days later with round-the-clock morphine. Appeared, according to the kids, very comfortable. Every 4 hours morphine. The kids maintained a vigil. It took about 5 days for her to die with no fluid, no food, just the IV morphine. Not even IV morphine. It was morphine suppository. So that's how it ended. I think we need to end. So, see.
Was she conscious?
No, completely comatose is what the doctor used. So she had no response to pain or anything.
To mention, tomorrow morning we'll be looking at a case study dealing with the issue of suicide. So hope some of you can return and join us for that.
I was there.
Well, this brings it up.
Yes.
You've got people, you're dealing with people that be treacherous. And you're then put in the position of pushing the people back and deciding survival of the real people.
The deontologist approach basically says if there are two deontological principles in conflict, that you use the principle of utilitarianism to decide. So, if you've got a conflict between these, then you use
the conflict.
Maybe fidelity and justice, I don't know. Maleficent.
Well, no, honesty, he is dishonest, they're both dishonest.
Which is basically, you come back to the lesser of two evils, which is a utilitarian. Greatest good for the greatest number, but the least harm for the least, which is effectively both. Or, did you have the other thing that the deontologist might do is simply say, I would take
the best. And that's a lot of
it. It violates my principles, I won't be disappointed.
And those are
right.
Sure.
We don't.
Anyway, it's a fun ethical thing to do.
And if there's an opportunity, bring it up.
Please do.
It doesn't fit the ethical issue, but, you know, if you're looking for personal...
Yeah, I got all... We need another one, we'll call you up. Tell me your name.
Carolyn.
Carolyn. Okay.
I'm the lab leader.
Wonderful, good. Well, we'll call you if we need more.
Now, are you being nicer? Are you being nicer? You're gonna hurt Rebecca's feelings.
You don't take it personally. You know that you're...
She, well, she tried and then she
You have to get used to repentance so that you're...
You're trying to fire me emotionally and physically.
So your mom...
They knew enough to know what terrible condition was in.
My mom takes them.
And yet, of course,
it just means Rebecca has to do what they're upset.
You're going to get your toys.
I think so. I mean, if you're willing to stick it out once...
But he hadn't given you, had he given you any guidance ahead of time? See, this is that.
In some sense he had.
This is where having good guidance is.
And you will remember Rebecca.
Don't do anything.
Right. She's a treat to look at.
And there's a real, there is a real possibility of recovery.
Whereas this, you've got to think about these issues again.
I probably freaked out the first time.
And I think we made the wrong decision, but in some sense, I don't feel any guilt because I think there isn't any right wrong.
Thank you, Rebecca.
You're welcome.
See you again.
But I thought I would ask you whether you're planning to continue on medical ethical issues, because they're so, they're interesting in some sense. We're all going to deal with them. Many of us have dealt with them already. But they're so so fraught with technicalities. You know, the decision usually comes down to what are the chances of complete procedure done and so. I mean, it's not really the, I would myself be interested in applying this sort of principles versus ends to much more mundane issues that we face every day. I mean,
could you give me an example?
I don't know. You go to the grocery store and you get your groceries from home and you realize they overpaid you and change by a dollar. You go back to the grocery store. Well, you know, there's right here, that's it.
Or do you buy the green grapes?
That's more sort of get politics involved. This is just a basic honesty issue. You know, you've got principle of honesty, and you've got the, is it worth my time going back there? Maybe I don't go to the grocery store all the time. You know, it's good to take myself. That's what I've done now. Suppose it's some grocery store you're a lot likely to go to again. Well, you know, if you take morality seriously,
Does it make a difference?
Was it $20? Well, you know, I think a lot of us would go back. But $5, $1, probably not. And clearly, we're in 7 through 10 at that point.
Right, you're into these kinds of questions.
You know, and you teach your kids that way. Do you teach your kids?
But oftentimes, we teach
them. Dishonest at the level of a dollar and not 10? I don't know. Does that make sense?
See, my parents teach kids me that? A lot. They would have taught me that on this absolute.
Yeah. Yeah.
Out of the 10 cents, we would have gone back.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. Well, but we're now...
But I wouldn't do that myself. You know,
Well, I just suggest you, it might be interesting, I know you guys are experts in this field and so forth, and have a lot of experience, but maybe you can think about some kind of cases or some discussion at least where you're not doing the medical issues because, as I say, even though they're the most, in some sense, acute, we don't deal with them very often, and they often the decision really rests on these technical issues of you know, how much is invasive and what are the chances of a good outcome and you know, which is coming off the subject at hand here.
The next case we'll do will be a little bit different because it really is addressing the ethics of suicide and what are obligations to do in that. Well, it's a big issue. It's not a life.
But it's a trust between friends issue.
But it's not an issue so much of technology.
That's true. Yeah.
And how you do that.
Yeah.
And the third one is really going to deal with some of the questions of what happened. How do you do healthcare with scarce resources?
Yeah.
Which again has to do with technology, but it has more to do with the cost of technology in a society that has to make decisions. But you, yeah, we would, it would be interesting, I mean, if we had more time to develop a, take these to a lot of
Suppose you have a casual friend who's doing serious drugs, what do you do? Mm-hmm. You go to the cops? You ignore it? What do you do?
Well, this is similar for my friend tells you he's going to kill himself.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
various other things around it. I mean, this is harm.
Yes, that's true.
Potential harm. Like doing
well, you know, I might think about it.
But
I appreciate it because it's
It's gotten me thinking even more about this sort of daily ethical dilemma stuff. Because it is, as we said the first day, it is daily behavior.
When you hit the crisis, it poses in such stark terms, and then you have to start going back to the things about they overpaid me by 10 minutes.
Right.
What I do is,
I think if nothing else, we can somehow incorporate comments like that periodically and say, you know, this even could be based on something maybe you learned as a kid about honesty, or maybe, you know, we can think about some of the other more mundane, as you say, because I think you're right, and that way we can be more
What we can put out is this can give tools for ways to start thinking about those elements.
Are you getting sleepy, sweetie?
Good, well, you're doing a good job.
Tell your name.
I'm Robert Butel.
Robert,
You've got a neurologist. I shouldn't really tell him, but the guy, my brother-in-law, is a neurologist. He deals with this all the time. That's Dave.
He's the one that's asking all the good questions.
Is Dave the one married to the social worker, Chris?
Yeah.
He didn't tell me.
I probably shouldn't have told you that. He doesn't want that to be,
relevant information
here.
Excuse me. He let me know after about 45 minutes of conversation about almost everything.
I love it. Well,
he's a good guy.
That's appreciative.
I was impressed.
I think that people sort of mellow out about it because otherwise everybody else gets intimidated, including the presenters.
That's right.
And says, you know, geez, you know, am I screwed up on this?
Right.
I'm glad we're not doing a brain death case.
Right.
That's where I just let
it
go.
Right.
In fact, maybe we should have him do it.
Thanks.
Thank you. Did you just leave these back in that corner?
Yeah, I just rolled them up and left them back there. What'd you find, Rachel? What'd you find? I'll stick them back.
Oh, I didn't mention this Lutheran article. I will have to do that.
This is the last conversation. There are so many things that I want to be mentioning, you know, as we go along. You know, we point these as crisis run cases, but the values they point out are the ones we apply in everyday interactions.
And maybe we just need to throw in a few examples of those everyday interactions.
That's what we can consider maybe doing at the beginning.
Yeah.
What are you doing there, Rachel? I'm going to try and pull that microphone over on you.
You are a screwball. You're making your mother crazy. Only at Holden Village can you come into a session that I'm teaching.
You handled it just beautifully. It was non-invasive.
I know. I'm sweating.
Did Rebecca just reach her boots in?
She just keeps
going. Hi. I think it's the age, you know, it's a natural development stage.
Do you mind taking those?
Not at all.
Again?
You want me to take this? I don't know, I just take this all right now and just.
Yeah.
And we're meeting right after this, right?
Right. That's right, we might have like a half hour before the teaching staff all gathers.
Well, just come with, why don't I just go directly up? I've got all my stuff with
me.
Great. So. I don't think it's going to take us too much time to prepare.
No. Thank you.